This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily via the internet address www.parstoday.com/en. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Intelsat 902, and Eutelsat satellite, as well as via internet. You can also listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for more details.
Chapter Ali Imran from the Holy Quran, verses number 29 and 30, recited by Saeed Maliki.
A'udhu billahi minash shaytanir rajim. Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. قُلْ إِن تُخْفُوا مَا فِي صُدُورِكُمْ أَوْ تُبْدُوهُ يَعْلَمْهُ اللَّهُ وَيَعْلَمُ مَا فِي السماوات وما في الأرض والله على كل شيء يوم تجد كل نفس ما عملت من خير محضرا وما ويحذركم الله نفسه والله رؤوف بالعباد صدق
In the name of God, the Compassionate, the merciful. Say, whether you hide what is in your heart or manifest it, Allah knows it, and He knows whatever is in the heavens and whatever is in the earth, and Allah has power over all things. On the day that every soul shall find present what it has done of good and what it has done of evil, it shall wish that between it and that evil there were a long duration of time. And Allah makes you to be cautious of retribution from Himself, and Allah is compassionate to the servants.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Here's a look at our top stories this hour. Iran says it will not tolerate the presence of thousands of armed terrorists close to its border with Iraq and will continue military operations against them. Another Palestinian youth loses his life after being critically wounded by Israeli forces during a raid west of the occupied West Bank city of Salafet. Plus, China's president doubles down on peaceful reunification with Taiwan, but hints at Beijing having to use force if necessary.
Hello and welcome. Your world news come to you live from the Iranian capital, Tehran. It's good to have you with us.
Iran's top general says the country will not tolerate the presence of thousands of armed terrorists close to its borders and will continue military operations against them. Chief of Staff of the Iranian Armed Forces, Major General Mohammad Bogheri, was referring to the presence of armed terrorists backed by the U.S. and Israel in the Iraqi Kurdistan region. He said Iran has frequently warned the Iraqi Kurdistan's officials against allowing such armed groups to have bases there. Bogheri said the terrorist groups should either give up their arms and turn into non-military groups or be expelled by officials of the Kurdistan region. Iran's Islamic Revolution Guards Corps has launched a series of multi-pronged military attacks on terrorist bases in Iraq's Kurdistan region. The bases played a role in fueling violent riots across Iran in recent weeks. Iranian officials say the situation is under control at Tehran's Evin prison, where a fire broke out earlier in the day. According to authorities, firefighters put out the blaze, which broke out in one of the prison wards. It followed a brawl among a number of prisoners convicted of financial crimes and theft. Gunshots and explosions were also heard. At least 8 people have been injured during the incident, which caused no mortalities. Evin prison is located in the northern part of the Iranian capital. A Palestinian youth has succumbed to injuries he sustained during an attack by Israeli forces west of the occupied West Bank city of Salafet. 31-year-old Mujahid Ahmed Mohammed Dawood died after he was critically shot in the chest by Israeli forces earlier on Saturday. He was rushed to a hospital in Ramallah, where he was announced dead. Tensions have been running high across the occupied territories during past months. The Israeli military presses on with its crackdown against Palestinians following a series of deadly attacks on the regime's forces. Resistance groups say the attacks are in response to Israel's atrocities. Nearly 170 Palestinians have been killed by Israeli forces in the West Bank since the start of this year, 15 in October alone. A large protest was held in the besieged Gaza Strip following the Friday prayer to support Al-Quds and Al-Aqsa Mosque. The demonstration comes amid an increase in Israeli violations against Palestinians in the occupied Holy City. Ashraf Shannon reports.
Palestinian resistance movement Hamas has held a big protest in the Gaza Strip to condemn the surge of Israeli attacks in Al-Quds and on the Al-Aqsa Mosque. People thronged the streets of the blockaded territory following the Friday prayer to take part in the event. Protesters shouted slogans against the Israeli regime and vowed to stand with Al-Quds. In recent days, extremist Jewish settlers backed by Israeli forces have been violating the sanctity of Al-Aqsa Mosque compound in Al-Quds. Palestinian resistance movement Hamas has warned the Israeli regime against violations in Al-Quds and asserted that armed resistance is the key to reaching freedom.
We condemn the Zionists' provocations in Al-Aqsa Mosque, and we salute the freedom fighters in the occupied West Bank and Al-Quds. Today, we're entering a new era where armed resistance against Zionist occupiers is the strategic choice, not only in Gaza, but also in the occupied West Bank, Al-Quds, and everywhere in Palestine.
Protesters also expressed their adherence to resistance as the best way to defend Al-Quds against Israeli aggression and attacks.
We came today to show our unwavering support for the armed resistance in the occupied West Bank and Al-Quds. The Zionists are desecrating Al-Aqsa Mosque and they only understand the language of force.
Palestinians in Gaza have expressed their willingness to sacrifice their lives for the sake of liberating Al-Quds. Occupied by Israeli forces in 1967, Al-Quds has been at the core of the Palestinian struggle for justice and freedom.
Al-Quds is the core of our struggle against the Zionist enemy, and we are willing to die in order to protect it. Zionist forces and settlers are desecrating Al-Aqsa, and we must escalate the resistance against the Zionist occupiers.
This is while Palestinians consider Al-Quds as the capital of a future Palestinian state. Palestinians here are calling for stepping up all forms of resistance against Israeli plots over Al-Quds and Al-Aqsa Mosque. Ashraf Shanan, Gaza.
The recent comments by Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas about his mistrust of the U.S. and his contentment with Russia's position toward Palestine put into perspective why Abbas and Palestinians as a whole do not trust the U.S. to have their interests in mind in any sort of negotiations. That is why they reject any U.S. role in future peace talks between Israel and Palestine.
Whether signed in the White House or overseen by a U.S. president or secretary of state, the United States has almost always had a role in any and all negotiations between Palestinian and Israeli sides. Looking at some of the more important instances of these talks, one can think of the first Oslo Accord in 1993 that was signed in Washington in the presence of then-U.S. President Bill Clinton. The 1999 Sharm el-Sheikh Memorandum that was signed in Egypt was also overseen by the U.S. through Madeleine Albright, then Secretary of State of the Clinton administration. The unsuccessful Camp David summits in the year 2000 was overseen directly by Bill Clinton himself. Following the unsuccessful peace talks, Clinton would make another effort at influencing the Israeli-Palestinian relations through the aptly named Clinton parameters, showing the extent of his and U.S. involvement in the talks. Sometimes this influence even meant that the fate of Palestine would be discussed without the participation of any Palestinian representative, as was the case in the Camp David Agreement in 1978, which was signed by Egyptian President, Israeli Prime Minister, and then U.S. President Jimmy Carter, without even an Arabic version of the documents. These showed the never-wavering U.S. Pledge of Allegiance to Israel, a pledge that will always protect Israeli interests which would automatically go against Palestinian interests. Among the most important of these interests is a trinity of inalienable rights defined by the Palestine National Council in 1974, which consists of Palestinians' right to self-determination, an independent state, and most importantly, right of return. The most recent example of neglecting these rights occurred in 2020. During Trump's tenure, the deal of the century was presented, which many later called the flop of the century. The Trump peace plan was titled Peace to Prosperity, a vision to improve the lives of the Palestinian and Israeli people. But it was far from that. The plan had been delayed by 2 years, and previously rejected by the Palestinians, who were not invited to the meeting. The plan never materialized, however, since, again, it was not representative of the Palestinians' rights on major core issues of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict.
One unresolved issue in the Israeli-Palestinian conflict is what's known as the right of return. It means that Palestinian refugees, be it first generations and their descendants, have a right to the property they have left behind or inherited from their ancestors. This principle, however, would require Israeli settlers to leave the houses they have occupied, which has never been acceptable for the Israeli regime.
The first time Israel attempted to make the smallest bit of compromise was at the Camp David summit in 2000. Israel said it would be willing to allow 100,000 Palestinian refugees back to their homeland, while the millions of others had to be resettled wherever they were at the time. Also, Yasser Arafat, then chairman of the Palestine Liberation Organization, would have to forego the idea of right of return completely from then on. Similar ludicrous proposals that were rejected by Arafat were all proposed with the U.S. being on board with these proposals. The U.S. involvement in the so-called peace talks have time and again shown Palestinians and their officials that the U.S. is not to be trusted as a neutral party. On the sidelines of the sixth summit of the Conference on Interaction and Confidence-Building Measures in Asia in Kazakhstan, Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas had a meeting with Russian President Vladimir Putin. In it, he expressed that he is happy with Russia's position on Palestine. He also said that he would only accept U.S. involvement in the conflict resolution process if other parties of the Quartet on the Middle East were present. The Middle East Quartet, established in Madrid in 2002, is a foursome of nations and international and supranational entities involved in mediating the Israeli-Palestinian peace negotiations. Its members are the United Nations, the United States, the European Union, and Russia. Palestine's hand is now one of unity, since the Palestinian factions have all established peace amongst themselves, including Hamas and Fatah. Palestinian factions signed reconciliation agreements in Algeria. Hamas, Fatah, and 12 other Palestinian groups agreed to hold legislative and presidential elections within 1 year after the successful talks held in Algiers. Meanwhile, when it comes to peace talks between Israel and Palestine, Abbas has stressed that Washington should not be given free hand to act alone in resolving the decades-long Palestine-Israeli conflict.
Moving on, China's president says his government is committed to peaceful reunification with Taiwan, but might have to use force if necessary. Xi Jinping rejected any forms of separatism and interference over the self-ruled island, which China considers as part of its territory. Beijing is strongly opposed to Washington's military ties with Taiwan, calling the U.S. military presence in the region provocative. Xi also pointed out that Beijing is against a Cold War mentality in international politics and interference in other countries' internal affairs. He also praised the current stable conditions in Hong Kong, which he said has made a transition from chaos to governance. He insisted that Hong Kong must be ruled by patriots, reaffirming a 2020 legislation that bans non-patriots from positions of political power in the city. Xi was addressing the five-yearly Congress of the ruling Communist Party. Andrew Leung, an independent China specialist, is with us from Hong Kong. Andrew, welcome to the program. Thank you for being with us. Let's just first begin by discussing the significance of the Communist Party Congress and considering the fact that Xi Jinping looks set to win a third term as party leader and the head of state. What do we know about his plans for a likely third term as at this point?
Well, it's almost a shoo-in because according to the Harvard Kennedy School, the Communist Party in recent decades, under the tutelage of the Communist Party, especially under Xi Jinping, has won a huge support from the Chinese people. In fact, the level of support has multiple ranks above Western countries, including the United States, and that's according to Harvard Kennedy School recent study. Now, plus the fact that there is no other credible rival candidate in the horizon. But on the other hand, apart from the reason for the third term, is because President Xi, and in fact the Communist Party, sees that China is at a critical stage of its trajectory, trying to lift China up to a different, higher plane to realize the China dream. The second, so-called second centenary of China dream is that China will become a strong and wealthy, democratic and also harmonious, civilized and beautiful country in the sense of ecological balance and ecological improvements. So all these are huge challenges to take on. And I think that there is consensus within the party that President Xi needs a third term at least to realize the China dream. Now, as far as China is Taiwan is concerned, of course, part of the China dream is maintaining a territorial integrity, including Taiwan and, of course, Hong Kong. Hong Kong is now was praised in President Xi's speech for returning to normalcy because of the overcoming the so-called black protests, you know, with violence and holding Hong Kong's law and order to ransom. But as far as Taiwan is concerned, after the Pelosi visit, Beijing published another white paper, the third of its kind, on Taiwan, stressing the preference for peaceful unification, but without giving up the military solution. Because at the end of the day, most Taiwanese people do not want unification, but neither do they want to declare independence, because that would trigger Armageddon in the Taiwan Strait and Taiwan itself. But most of them just want to maintain the status quo forever. But unfortunately, the status quo means the United States continues to hollow out the concept of one China policy by creating more and more diplomatic space for Taiwan as if Taiwan was a separate country, and also arming Taiwan to the teeth, turning Taiwan into a military porcupine within tradition law.
Right. So you talked about Taiwan, the issue of Taiwan that Xi Jinping talked about in his address. Now, let's just discuss Hong Kong. President Xi also lauded Hong Kong's transition from chaos to governance. Can you please tell us more about that?
Well, because from 2019 to even to, the best part of 2021, Hong Kong was seized by this so-called black protest involving a great deal of violence, petrol bombs being thrown around, a police headquarters being surrounded, then even the Chinese Beijing's institutions are being attacked and or defaced. And then there is evidence to suggest that there is a lot of money hidden behind financing all these so-called protests. And there is a definite signs of color revolution trying to overturn Hong Kong's governance and to seize power. Because what the protests want is really to paralyze the legislature so that nothing gets done. And then that demand is actually quite ridiculous, if I may say so, because under Hong Kong's basic law, Hong Kong's constitution, it was Beijing who introduced the idea of one man, one vote, universal suffrage. That these provisions were not included in the joint declaration with Britain, not included. It was included in Hong Kong's constitution at Beijing's initiative. However, the conditions are that for universal suffrage, the candidates must be pre-screened. But that's not acceptable, of course, to the so-called Democrats and by Western countries. But the reality is that Hong Kong is not a separate country. Hong Kong is a special administrative region of China. And then the leader of Hong Kong must have the confidence of Beijing and work with Beijing.
Andrew, I appreciate your time. Thank you so much for coming on. Andrew Leung, an independent China specialist from Hong Kong.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en. Supplication on Sundays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. In the name of Allah, from whom I hope for nothing but bounty, and from whom I fear nothing but justice. I rely only upon His word, and I cling only to His cord. In Thee I seek sanctuary, O possessor of pardon and good pleasure. From wrong and enmity, and from the changes of time, and the recurrence of sorrows, and from the striking of mishaps, and from the expiration of my term before preparation and readiness. From Thee I seek guidance to that wherein is righteousness and being set right. From Thee I seek help in that which is linked to success and favorable response. Thee I beseech for the garment of well-being and its completion, and for the covering of health and its permanence. I seek refuge in Thee, my Lord, from the goadings of the Satans. And I seek protection in Thy sovereignty from the injustice of the sovereigns. So accept my past prayers and fasting, and make my tomorrow and what is after better than my present hour and my today. And exalt me in my clan and my people, and protect me in my waking and my sleeping. For Thou art Allah, the best guardian, and Thou art the most merciful of the merciful. O Allah, I am quit before Thee on this day of mine and on all Sundays that follow it, of associating others with Thee and of heresy. And I devote my supplication sincerely to Thee, addressing myself to Thy response. And I observe the acts of obedience to You for the hope of Your rewards. So, bless Muhammad, the best of Thy creation, the summoner to Thy truth. Exalt me with Thy exaltation, which is never made to suffer loss. And protect me with Thy eye, which never sleeps. And seal my affair by cutting me off from everything but Thee and my life with forgiveness. Surely Thou art the All-Forgiving, the All-Compassionate.
In the limelight.
The global transition from unipolar world order to a multipolar one has now become the gospel truth, with China ascending globally and Russia challenging the West forcefully. But how Muslims can secure a front row seat in this once-in-a-century transition? Leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, answered this strategic question in his recent speech before Muslim scholars participating in a pro-unity conference held by Iran. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites for further details. Stay tuned, please. Kayhan, international staff writer, wrote, "When the leader of the Islamic Revolution calls the Islamic Republic of Iran is a mighty, unshakable tree, he is not exaggerating. As a matter of fact, he is speaking the undeniable truth. As the avowed enemies of the Iranian people very well know from their string of failures of the past 43 years during which they have always ended up in a state of dizziness with badly bruised heads bleeding from the hits received from the twigs of the firmly rooted tree. The mighty, unshakable tree of the Islamic Republic, whose steadily growing branches ensure the security and welfare of the Iranian people, in addition to providing shade for the independent governments, movements, and people of the region, has foiled the American bids to invade, hatch coups, impose a war, murder scientists and senior military commanders, unleash the most macabrely murderous terrorists in such friendly countries as Syria, Iraq, and Afghanistan, illegally freeze assets, clamp economic sanctions, and instigate characterless men and women to indulge in scattered cases of urban terrorism." Washington is totally wrong in thinking the outcast of the society with no roots in either Islamic faith or Iranian culture and who cannot even be called humans in view of their desecration of sanctities, obscene sloganeering and indecent attire can axe at least a few branches of this giant tree. And there is another question here. How can a country nurtured by sacred blood of martyrs and flourishing on the faith and dedication of scores of millions of Iranian Muslim men and women active in all spheres of society be overrun and handed over to the minions of the US, Britain, France, and the fake regime of Israel? Revolution requires roots to triumph and continue its triumphant course, as the dedicated Iranian Muslim masses have constantly shown from 1978 till this date, helping the country achieve spectacular success in all fields, including medicine, modern science and technology. No wonder the leader of the Islamic Revolution, at the mention of whose name the US and its comrades in crimes shake in fear, has called the Islamic Republic of Iran a mighty, unshakable tree. Also, Tehran Times wrote this headline saying, "Unity key to sublime position in a changing world." The leader of the Islamic Revolution said, "Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei has explained how Muslims can secure a sublime position in a world in transition. The global transition from unipolar world order to a multipolar one has now become the gospel truth, with China ascending globally and Russia challenging the West forcefully. But how Muslims can secure a front row seat in this once-in-a-century transition?" Ayatollah Khamenei answered this strategic question in his recent speech before Muslim scholars participating in a pro-unity conference held by Iran. The 36th International Islamic Unity Conference was held in Tehran with Iranian President Ayatollah Sayyid Ebrahim Raisi as the key speaker. The participants of the conference, the heads of the three branches of government, including judiciary, executive, and legislative, and a group of government officials, met with Ayatollah Khamenei on the occasion of the birth anniversaries of Prophet Muhammad and Imam Sadiq. In his speech, the leader spoke about the character of Prophet Muhammad, saying, "The Holy Prophet's character is unique in the entire universe. His birthday is a very important, great day. Calling the birthday of the Prophet an Eid is not just for holding a celebration and commemorating him. It is also for learning from him and setting the Prophet as an example." He said, according to a readout of the speech put out by the website of Khamenei.ir, "One of the lessons from Prophet Muhammad for the Islamic nation is the Prophet grieves for your suffering. Of course, this doesn't just refer to Muslims at the time of the Prophet. It means the sufferings of the Muslims in Palestine, Myanmar, etc. today grieve his pure soul." Ayatollah Khamenei then addressed the suffering of present-day Muslims and linked it to global imperialism. "Global imperialism rejoices at the suffering of Muslims. Why are Muslim nations suffering like this? Why are the Muslims suffering economically, politically, and from aggression, colonialism, civil wars, etc.? One of the most important reasons is the division of Muslims," he said, adding, "The Muslim nation's current sufferings are due to their division. This is what happens when we are divided, not concerned about each other, and even hostile to each other at times. The Quran says, when you are divided, you will be humiliated. Thus, you will help others to dominate you." The leader of the Islamic Revolution also pointed to how the enemy sows division among Muslims. He said the enemy does not want to see Muslims united. Instead, it wants them disunited. Furthermore, the enemy planted Israel in the region to serve as a base for the West. According to the leader, the enemy wants the opposite of unity between Muslims today. They created a cancerous cell in the region, the Zionist regime, to serve as a base for Western enmity against Islam. They brought the murderous, brutal Zionists to oppressed Palestine, creating a fake government to do this. In this context, the leader addressed the trend of normalization between Israel and some Arab states. He said normalization with Israel is an act of treason. "The enemies are working to do something so that the Zionist regime, this cancer cell, won't be called the enemy anymore. They wish to create more discord between the countries of the region. These normalizations are one of the biggest acts of treachery against Muslims," the leader said. Since 2020, some Arab states, namely Bahrain, Morocco, the United Arab Emirates, and Sudan, have moved to establish full diplomatic relations with the fake regime of Israel, despite warnings from Iran and discontent in Arab public opinion.
IRIB English Radio.
please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Hungry humans. Part 2.
This is the battlefield. A manifestation of humans' cruelty. Everything happens fast and in a riotous way in the battlefield. But sometimes wars are silent and hidden with an attractive and charming look. Such wars are sometimes more threatening and result in more victims. Like the war that I want to tell you about. A war that you may not have even imagined, but we are in the middle of the battlefield. I want to start my story with a question. Why is fast food so popular in this era? One recipe and one taste. Everything is similar. Ready-to-eat foods are without stories because there is no time to tell stories in the middle of the battlefield. Find them in these hypermarkets. There is no story here. The story of each product is summarized in barcodes and a few lines and numbers below them. It doesn't matter where the food comes from, they say here instead of everywhere. Here, like on the battlefield, everything happens fast.
So I would not say that it caused the Industrial Revolution. But I would go so far as to say that in England, it helped make the Industrial Revolution possible because it sustained the people who were doing the industry. When factory workers got off shift, the last thing they really wanted to do was cook. And right outside the factory gates were people who had set up carts with ovens, and they would bake the potatoes, and they would sell them for cheap. And people would have a hot baked potato coming right off the factory floor, a nice instant treat. And that was, in a sense, the beginning of modern street food. So the pace of life began to increase. I think the industrialization happened first, and the potato became necessary for it to continue or made it easier.
Can you give us a talk about the suffering imposed, for example, to hands in factory farming?
In some cases, the confinement is very tight. An example of that would be for hens who are laying eggs. So the standard industrial cage, and that's not just for one hen, that might be for four or five hens. So each hen in this cage has just a very small amount of space. They're very crowded together and they can't even stretch their wings. In fact, some of the cages are so small that even one bird in the cage could not stretch her wings fully. And instead of there being one bird, there are four or five birds.
One out of eight people in today's world is either very fat or very thin. The rest of the people may not be fat or thin, but they do not use diverse nutrition resources. It means that in today's world, everyone is hungry in some way, even if they don't know it themselves. Considering the amount of destruction of Earth and the resources and this amount of mass production of food, why should people be hungry? Mass and abundant production cannot be a warning. Age of mass production. In this era, mass profit was only possible with mass production. So every obstacle in the way of mass production had to be removed. Machine-processed foods were the same in size and ingredients. They were produced and consumed with the same strategy. This means that the consumer's tastes should have been similar to each other. From then on, the good food was cooked as fast as possible and was also easy to eat. The hero of this story was sausage. Sausage is a standardized food that everyone without any taste likes. Its components cannot be distinguished from each other and it can be produced and consumed very quickly. But food like calipoche has characteristics that make it different from sausage. It is not a dish that everyone likes. It takes a long time to cook this dish. The ones who eat this kind of meal know exactly what they're going to eat. If I want to eat sheep's eyes, I know exactly what part of the sheep I want to eat. I can know about the different parts of a sheep's body. Many don't like this dish and never enter a tabakhi. In a tabakhi, the cook plays a very important role. Most of the time, he is the hero of the story. Customers know the story of calipoche with its cook. The green eyes of the cook are part of the taste of the food that is eaten. Concept like local customers was against the trend that wanted to make food global. The good food is loved by all people everywhere in the world. Food that can be mass produced, mass sold, and mass profitable. The new era is about machines and pace. In this period, the good food is in harmony with machines. It means that it can be produced with the help of a machine and can be eaten in cars. The story of unifying the tastes of all the people of the world started from serving food inside of vehicles. McDonald's was the first restaurant that started serving food in the cars. An idea that, after a few decades, turned this restaurant into the second largest private restaurant in the world. Now McDonald's has 37,800 branches in 119 countries. These branches provide food with similar tastes to 64 million customers around the world on a daily basis. McDonald's quickly removed taste and chef from the story of food. In this age, no one asks himself why all the people everywhere in the world should love the same kind of food. This fast food company went beyond a way of consuming food and became a lifestyle. George Ritzer, American sociologist, uses McDonaldization as a new concept to explain McDonald's impacts on different communities. He believes that McDonald's influence is expanded. In this opinion, in the new age, everything is becoming part of McDonaldization.
You know, one of the criticisms of McDonald's and the fast food industry is that they have industrialized food. Well, McDonaldization, as I've defined it, is the process by which the principles of the fast food restaurant have come to dominate that industry. But not only that industry, many other industries and many other parts of society, and also has come to be dominate globally. You know, any business, especially in the food industry, especially that seeks to be global in nature, has to McDonaldize its operation.
According to George Ritzer, every successful business at the global level is inevitably forced to be under McDonaldization theory. I asked him what other things have changed in the world apart from the business under the term of McDonaldization.
Their sandwiches are pretty much the same from one time to another time and from one place to another place. And so it turns out that if you, and McDonald's is in about 120 countries in the world, and it turns out that if you order a Big Mac or anything, it's pretty much going to be similar or the same from one country to another country. One of the many negative points of view is it's led to a global decline in taste as far as food is concerned. I don't know what kind of impact it's had in Iran because you don't have McDonald's, and I don't think you have, I don't think any of the copies that you have there are as powerful as McDonald's is. But, you know, in most part of the world, it's not destroyed indigenous food and cuisine. It's certainly limited the interest of in it, especially among young people. What McDonald's has done, what fast food restaurants have done, is to alter behavior, and in the process, alter people's values. So, for example, people increasingly value things that are fast. They want things done quickly. And in part, that's a product of a fast food society where the emphasis is on things that are fast. So people become accustomed to getting food fast, and so they want all kinds of other things fast as well. Thank you.
Speed is a modern phenomenon that has become a disaster for human lives and the Earth. Speed in food production and consumption means harming Mother Earth. It means the ruination of water, soil, and the environment. Fast food causes the loss of diversity and cultural values and even increases the number of hungry people, and it harms people's health. Many years passed until they knew about this widespread destruction. People looked for a quick solution to prevent this destruction. Preventing widespread meat eating and finding an alternative to it was the first thing that came to their minds in this era. So movements were formed to announce this alternative. These movements, which are sometimes accompanied by famous figures, seek to eliminate animal meat and replace it with other creatures. Insects are one of the serious proposals to be used instead of the meat of animals. Those people who are the fans of entomophagy believe the land and resources used to produce 200 grams of beef are equal to the land and resources used to grow 2,000 grams of insects. So it is probably better to raise and eat insects to raise cattle.
In the limelight.
The number of suicides among American veterans has increased in the past decade to the extent that the number is higher than the total number of American soldiers killed in the wars in Iraq, Afghanistan, and Vietnam. Publication of news and events related to troubles and problems as well as suicide of American veterans is censored by the media affiliated with the U.S. Republicans and Democrats. Today, the majority of veterans who have been engaged in looting, occupying, and killing innocent people in Afghanistan and Iraq admit that their presence and participation in the bloody game of the White House and the Pentagon only led to the regression in their personal and social lives. We have taken a look at some of the world media's coverage of this issue. Please stay with us for more. The website of NBC News has more on this story. A new study found more military veterans died by suicide than the Department of Veteran Affairs had previously reported. According to a study released on Saturday, 17th of September, by America's Warrior Partnership, a national non-profit organization that works to end veteran suicide, the number of suicide among former service members is 1.37 times greater in 8 states than the Department of Veteran Affairs had reported from 2014 to 2018. The report found if those states represent a national rate, that would mean about 24 veterans die by suicide each day, compared with the Department of Veteran Affairs' average of 17.7 suicides in that time frame. Jim Lorraine, America's Warrior Partnership president, who served in the Air Force for 22 years, said, "It's devastating. I'm not only a veteran myself, my son serves, My son-in-law serves as well. My wife is a veteran. I know a lot of veterans who have died from suicide. The report examined data from Alabama, Florida, Maine, Massachusetts, Michigan, Minnesota, Montana, and Oregon. America's Warrior Partnership, or AWP, said those eight states, which represent 18% of all U.S. veterans, were the only states to provide usable data, adding that most states had been barred from releasing data because of confidentiality restrictions. The report found veterans who served less than 3 years were at the greatest risk of suicide, and the odds of dying by suicide increased by 56% if the veteran had received a demotion. The report said former members of the Coast Guard were most likely to die by suicide, followed by Marine Corps, the Army, Navy, and Air Force service members. The website of Global News explains more about the same story. A comprehensive new study has revealed that American military veterans are committing suicide at a much higher rate than the U.S. government is reporting. According to the new study, an average of 24 former service members are taking their own lives every day, 37% more than what has been reported by the U.S. Department of Veteran Affairs. In addition, 20 veterans on average are dying each day by self-injury mortality, such as drug overdose. According to the new study, the official figures are lower because of undercounting related to drug overdose deaths and service record errors, which reviewed census death data from 2014 to 2018 for eight states. It found thousands of cases of suspected or confirmed suicides that were not included in federal reports. Jim Lorraine, a U.S. Air Force veteran, said, "These are all preventable deaths. The number is less important than the methodology of tracking them and making sure we have an accurate count that can lead us to prevention steps." Jim Lorraine said many drug-related deaths in the states that researchers reviewed were classified as accidents or undermined, even though there were indications that they should have been tagged as suicide. There were also cases where the military history of the deceased individuals was incorrectly reported, resulting to a further undercounting of the number of veteran suicides. Suicide has been described as a national health crisis in the United States, with more than 45,000 Americans taking their own lives each year. Also, suicide rates among active duty U.S. military members are currently at an all-time high since record-keeping began after 9/11 and have been increasing over the past 5 years at an alarmingly steady pace. In fact, some branches of the U.S. Armed Forces are experiencing the highest rate of suicide since the Second World War. In 2021, research found that 30,177 active duty personnel and veterans who served in the military after 9/11 have died by suicide, compared to 7,057 service members killed in combat in those same 20 years. That is, military suicide rates are four times higher than deaths that occurred during military operations. The AmericanAddictionCenters.org website has more on the same story. A major yet preventable health problem in the United States is suicide. Sadly, veterans comprise nearly a quarter of all suicide deaths in the United States. In 2017, a team of researchers looking at data on more than 4.8 million veterans found that veterans with substance use disorders had twice the risk of suicide compared to those without a substance use disorder. Other commonly cited factors leading to increased suicide risk in veterans as well as other groups were anger, rage, mood swings and episodes of anxiety and agitation, expressing feelings of having no reason to live, increased alcohol abuse and or substance abuse, self-destructive and risky behaviors like driving while impaired. The suicide rate for veterans is 1.5 times higher than that of the general population. Comparing the rate among female veterans to non-veteran adult women, the rate is 2.5 times higher. From 2001 to 2014, the U.S. Department of Veteran Affairs reports an increased suicide rate among women using Department of Veteran Affairs services from 14.4 per 100,000 to 17.3 per 100,000 of the population. Suicide rate